Okay, we'll bring to order the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. Do we have a forum yet?
I see eight, or one shot, we don't.
Okay, we'll start anyway, and we just won't take any official actions until we get a quorum. So we can, oh, we got one now. All right, a quorum being present, go ahead and take roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Flanagan? Representative Hertas? Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Womer? Representative Lucero? Representative Neuberger? Representative O'Neill?
I'm here.
Representative Kwan?
Present.
Representative Rosenthal? Representative Schoen? Representative Ward?
Here.
And Representative Zerwas?
Okay, we'll take a motion for the approval of the minutes for March 23rd.
So moved.
Representative Considine moves the minutes of March 23rd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, our order of business today, it doesn't look too controversial. It probably we can get out of here as fast or as slow as anybody wants to talk. And go through the bills. Representative Slocum has House File 2710.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that. Where would you like it to go to next?
Civil law.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that House File 2710 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee, and it's my understanding there is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it, and I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay, and I guess we're supposed to just say referred to the Civil Law instead of passed now, so.
Okay.
All right, you, the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment to get it in the form the author would like it? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, to your bill as amended, Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was easy so far. I was ready to explain the amendment. It's pretty simple and it's technical and it puts
can you get over in front of the microphone a little bit, Representative? Thanks.
Yes.
Maybe change chairs there.
Let me just slide over a little bit.
Thanks.
How's that? Better?
You bet. Thank you much.
Better. Okay. It just puts it in line. Oh, okay. We're going to rotate. Puts it in line with the Senate bill. So less hassle in the long run. Bill 2710, House File 2710, makes some changes that are rather technical and reordering some sections to make it more user-friendly and readable regarding restraining orders for harassment. It allows greater protection for victims. It allows them to keep their location confidential, and it also increases due process. And I have people here. I have Raina Alexander, who will walk through the bill itself.
Okay, ma'am, if you give your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. My name is Raina Alexander, and I am the senior attorney at the Battered Women's Legal Advocacy Project, and I have been asked to come here and testify on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Thank you, Representative Slocum, for supporting this bill. Before I go into the bill, I'd like to give a very brief explanation of what a harassment restraining order, or a HRO, otherwise known as 609.748, is. It defines harassment as a single incident of physical or sexual assault or repeated incidences of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another, regardless of the relationship between the actor and the intended target. The nature of the relationship is an important distinction between the HRO and an order for protection, or an OFP, which is available under Chapter 518B. OFPs apply when domestic abuse, as defined under the statute, has occurred, and there is a relationship between the parties, which is either familial, intimate, or household members. Of particular concern to MnCASA and to BWLAP and other victim advocates is situations where the perpetrator is of sexual assault or stalking is not related to the victim, does not live with the victim, and is either unknown or an acquaintance to the victim. An order for protection or an OFP would not be an available option, but a harassment restraining order would. The harassment restraining order provides a party to stay away from another for a specific period of time, usually 2 years, or sometimes longer if there are repeated violations of the order. So, as Representative Solcom said, most of the amendments are, or the changes to the statute are technical and are some reordering to make the statute easier to use for petitioners and the respondents. Walking through the bills, looking at subdivision number 2, this would allow for an adult age 25 or older to petition on behalf of a minor if the court finds it's in the best interest of the minor. It also does some reordering for ease of reading. Subdivision 3A would waive the fees for the respondent when there is stalking or sexual assault is alleged by the petitioner. And it removes the obligation for petitioner fee or for the petitioner fees in court orders. A similar proposal has been made under the Order for Protection statute, and so we're putting the HRO statute in line with the Order for Protection statute. Subdivision 3B would allow a petitioner to request that their location or residence be confidential and only accessible to court personnel or law enforcement. This has been being done kind of in practice, but it would never really was in the statute, so something that we wanted to add to statute. Subdivision 4 is cleaning up of some language, but also adding, making it clear that the no contact provision of a harassment restraining order. Harassment restraining orders only have two types of relief: no harassment, no contact. It making clear that no contact includes things like social media and other electronic means as our society changes. It also adds changes for the requirement to be able to request a hearing. The statute right now is in conflict. 2 years ago, there was a change to the statute to change it from notice of that the respondent needed to request a hearing. It used to say within 45 days of issuance of the harassment restraining order. This was often an issue if for some reason the harassment restraining order wasn't served within 45 days. And so 2 years ago, there was a bill to change that to 20 days after service that the respondent had to request a hearing. That language of 45 days is in the statute twice, and it got missed in another spot. So only one spot got changed, the other spot didn't. So this bill will also be making the bill congruent with each or making the statute congruent with each other to 20 days after service that the respondent has to request a hearing. It also allows for the temporary order to become valid for 2 years if neither party requests a hearing. This has been standard practice. We're just making the language in the statute clear that that's what should happen. Subdivision 5 is, again, reordering and making some things clear about the 50-year order, just reordering it because kind of the 50-year order stuff, which already exists in statute, is just kind of shoved under a subdivision. So we created a new subdivision, Subdivision 5A, to make a 50-year order have its own subdivision. Subdivision 5B. Precludes requirements on a hearing or on subsequent or extension orders where that initial harassment restraining order was issued without another hearing. So it was issued ex parte, nobody requested a hearing, there was not a hearing, so therefore if somebody seeks an extension of that harassment restraining order, they would not then have to seek a hearing. The respondent would still have the opportunity to request a hearing in the exact same way they could with the ex parte 20 days after service. 5C combines all that 50-year orders into one stat and one part of subdivision. Subdivision 6 adds language similar to the order of protection, allowing warrantless arrest if there's a violation. Again, that's our that's just making clear that has already been happening. We just want to make it clear that in statute that that was possible. And then finally, Subdivision 7, 8A and 8B is clarifying service and how service should happen. Are there any questions?
If no questions, we move to your next testifier.
I'm Laura Taken-Holtze from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I'm just here to answer procedural questions. Rena's the really smart one. So.
Okay, members, questions on Representative Slocum's bill? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a really quick question. Since you're waiving a fee, do you have a fiscal note?
Anyone?
At this moment, my understanding is there is not a fiscal note, although our understanding is that the order for protection change, the fiscal note was $24,000 in the first year and $34,000 in future years. However, there's a belief that actually since you'll have less people filing for informa pauperis or fee waiver, there should actually be the fiscal note should be zero. Does that, because now what happens is respondents, when they have to pay the fee, they file for fee waiver, which involves a filing. It means the court administration has to run paperwork. It goes up to the judicial officer. Judicial officer has to sign it. So there will be less of that process because now they won't have to file for fee waiver.
Representative Rhea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm actually carrying the OFP language. So it sounds like almost the exact same fiscal note as we receive for the OFP.
At this point, there is no fiscal note, but that's what we would expect.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolf, did you want to comment?
Mr. Chair, only that there was a fiscal note requested on the Senate version of the bill. I just had a short conversation with Janet Marshall of the courts. She said that one should be finished shortly.
Okay, any other questions? Any closing remarks, Representative Slocum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good bill. It has a Senate author. It has Carla Nelson. So it's a bipartisan bill. It's a good bill. Vote for it.
Okay, and anybody from the audience testify? If not, Representative Hilsman, you want to renew your motion to the bill as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion. And where is it going again? Civil law.
Civil law.
I renew my motion that House File 2710 be re-referred to civil law as amended.
Okay, hearing that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom, House File 2777, and would you like to move your bill when you're ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 277 be recommended, be re-referred to the General Register.
Okay. And no amendments, so Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In 2000, the legislature developed strict procedures and protocols for emergency medical personnel who provide out-of-the-hospital emergency services at any time when blood or bodily fluids have been a source of a significant exposure to them. So basically, if you are providing these services to someone outside of a hospital and you come in contact, have significant contact with a bodily fluid, there needs to be a procedure by which you can have the person tested for different communicable diseases. And there currently is a court procedure where you can summon someone into court to get a test ordered, but if the person doesn't show up, there's no procedure to actually force them to come into court or to take them into custody if they're not cooperative in giving that blood sample. So this doesn't change the procedure for getting someone into court. It doesn't change the procedure for when it would be allowed. This just says that if someone fails to come to court when there has been a significant exposure, we have the ability to have the hearing without them present if they've been given proper notice and chose not to show up. And if they refuse to give the sample, we can take them into custody for the sole purpose of taking the sample and then release them when they have provided the sample. With me is Denny Flaherty from the Minnesota Peace and Police Officers Association. But members, I want to make this very clear that it covers police officers, firefighters, paramedics, paid or unpaid ambulance personnel, Good Samaritans. It's any time there is a significant exposure that this comes into play.
Okay, welcome, sir. Would you give your name and title and begin?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is a group of rank-and-file police officers that work for all levels of government in our state. And I'm here to speak in support of this legislation, which we think is needed to protect all of our emergency personnel, paid or unpaid, throughout our state. And this actually was brought to our attention by a police officer who, while making an arrest, had a gentleman spit directly into her face and most specifically into the eye. And following the arrest, she, of course, went to seek emergency treatment, and an infectious disease specialist verified that she, in fact, did have a significant exposure and that she would need to immediately take some emergency steps to initiate what they call a PEP program, which just simply is post-exposure, and it's a prophylaxis, which can take quite a time. It can take from a month to 6 months, and it involves injections and the emotional scarring and worrying whether this person was in fact infected by HIV or hepatitis B or C. And all of this can be avoided by just simply obtaining a blood sample from the source individual. And in most cases, that is done. The blood sample comes up clear, and the emergency worker, does not have to continue the program or worry about that for the following months. In this case, he refused. So they did, in fact, seek a court hearing. He was properly noticed of the hearing, and he failed to show. And the judge had no further ability to do anything in this particular case. What this bill would do is give judges the opportunity to order a blood test and direct law enforcement to take the person into custody for the purpose of that test, and just that test only, and then they would of course be released. I want to make sure I communicate properly. These occupational exposures are rare, and it's not something that does happen every day, but the problem that we have when we can't get the source individual to provide blood, this is a brutal, the care that's needed following this is no one should have to be subjected to it. And it's not just the injections of drugs and so forth, but you have to you're counseled on your sexual behavior with your spouse. You have to practice safe sex. You're continually worried about, did you get was some disease transmitted to you? And no one should have to be subjected to that. And as I emphasize, all of it can simply be prevented by doing a blood test to determine if there are any blood pathogens that would indicate that the person is infected. So I certainly would hope that you would support this bill, because it really is necessary.
Thank you, Director. And Representative Hertaus and Representative Considine. And then Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, as I'm reading the provisions of the standard language, it doesn't appear that this protects somebody who might be a Good Samaritan or any first responder, should it not?
Mr. Chair, it's not in this particular section of the amendment, but it's in the statute as a whole. So if you read the whole statute, it does include them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other group I didn't hear was correctional officers, and I actually did witness in my career a correctional officer that county jail that went through 18 months of agony as he waited to find out if he had been exposed to HIV.
Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't believe that they are included in the statute. This statute really covers the folks who are out in emergency settings, out in the field, and so I don't believe corrections officers are in this particular statute. I have no objection to giving them that kind of protection, but this this just didn't include them in the current statute.
Mr. Chair, I would like to see them included. It's not so much for the state prison correctional officers, because I think they have access to their medical files, but people that work in jails, and again, in this particular case, the next day he made bail and was gone. And yeah, then they couldn't get him to come back and submit any kind of records or get a test. So,
Representative Hilstrom, I'll leave that up to you how you two work that out, if that's okay.
That's okay with me, hearing that we can do that.
All right, any other, let's see, Representative Dean and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm guessing this would be to Representative Hilstrom. So as I think about and what this does, it allows the court to order the source individual be taken into custody to obtain the blood sample. But that's one part of it. Then there's actually the blood sample part of it, because I'm assuming that an individual would have to willingly give the blood sample, and I see that it's they can only be held for 24 hours without receiving a court hearing. So the question is, could an individual with a court hearing actually be held indefinitely till they do give a blood sample?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, once the court has ordered that a blood sample be taken, it can be forcibly removed. They would be taken to a medical facility. That can happen already under, you know, when you get a search warrant to take somebody's blood, they don't necessarily voluntarily let you take it. And once you have that search warrant, you can take it. And this is no different under this statute.
Representative.
So just follow up. So officers can take an individual in a laboratory setting where a blood sample could be drawn, and that person could be strained in such a manner in which blood sample could be taken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Current law allows that to happen. This person would be transported to a medical facility. The medical facility would take blood in the same manner they take blood for any other search warrant.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson and then Neuberger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I was one of the unfortunate officers that had a incident. I was in a fight, and it's actually a fight for my life with the gentleman that was very much high on PCP and some other things. And my entire uniform, and I was full of his blood by the time it was done, because before I got there, he had been cutting himself with glass. That was before 2000, before this original law came in. So I went through that 18-plus months of agony wondering what was going on, because this gentleman refused to do a test. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hilstrom, again, on behalf of EMS providers, for bringing this forward. This is a breath of fresh air. Maybe to just to address some of Representative Dean's concerns, I can understand kind of where you were going with this, but there are so many pathogens nowadays, biohazardous pathogens, that are more deadly than the weapons that you could stick inside your coat. What this addresses, members, I could sit here and relay my history, but I won't, because I've lost count of how many times I've been exposed to everything. It's when we're not able to figure out what it is that's making us sick is when we have the problem. And I, again, thank you, Representative Hilstrom, because one of the issues that has come forward, unfortunately, is I've had coworkers who have been exposed to methicillin-resistant staph MRSA, and also vancomycin-resistant VRE. Point being is that if this stuff is everywhere, you get exposed to this. Sorry, members, I'm getting a little the experience was pretty tough for these people that are part of my life. Some of them have lost parts of their body. They had to be removed due to these infections. And are no longer working in the field. But point I'm trying to make is, Representative Hilstrom, is if you are exposed to something like this, and the person, especially if they willfully did so, used their pathogen as a weapon, and you cannot definitively trace that infection to that person. Oftentimes, you do not get the benefits, or you do not get the compensation that you should get. If someone assaults you physically as a paramedic and beats you up, you can go after and press charges, and it's very easy to ascertain what happened to you and why you're hurt. If someone that has MRSA or VRE or C. diff or Aspergillus or name, pick your flavor, if they use that as a weapon, or if they don't, if they expose you to that and you get sick and you can't prove that person did it and you've got 18 months to wait, anything can happen in 18 months, and then you take your case back because of your lost time, your hospital bills and everything else, and it's really hard to prove that this person gave that to you because you've been working the street for the last 6 months. So how do you know it was that person, or how do you know it wasn't? So immediate testing, I think, goes a long way towards relieving this problem. And if, with your permission, I'll talk to you on the floor. I'd like to be a co-author on this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for folks who have concerns, I just want to make it really clear that currently there is a court procedure whereby this could happen. And unless the court actually orders that it's okay to go and pick up the person or that it's okay to take the blood, nothing will happen. So it will be reviewed by the court prior to that order being issued.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom, closing comments and then move your bill.
I ask members to vote yes.
What's that? Okay, you want to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion that House File 2777 be re-referred to the General Register.
Okay, we've heard the motion. No further discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Are you going to stay there for your next bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that House File 3005 be re-referred to the General Register.
Okay. Any amendments?
Thank you.
No amendments, so go ahead, Representative Filter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill was brought to me by the courts. This bill seeks to accomplish three things. The first is the court reporter statute cleanup. Members, this was all agreed to by the court reporters, the bargaining unit, the court reporter association, the judicial branch, the human services resources managers. That was all agreed to. It makes it so that there is a... It eliminates the need for the Commissioner of Corrections to be provided a transcript of the sentencings when a defendant is sent to the commissioner. It moves existing language, which permits the use of electronic recording equipment, an expedited child support process to the expedited child support hearing statute, where it really belongs. It updates existing language to reflect current job titles. It eliminates the need for court reporters to file a bond. It updates existing language reflected in current job titles. Some salary process pieces, again, all negotiated. It changes that there's a direct appeal of a referee order in probate and mental health court goes to the Court of Appeals instead of being re-referred to another judge who just signed off on the order. There's clarification of statutes related to penalty of perjury for documents that are provided to the court. So it's not just if you say something to the judge or you hand it to the judge, but when you file it, we're going to electronic filing, you're filing everything electronically. It needs to include those documents as well. And then there is a small repealer section that takes care of some outdated language. One that statute that limits, puts limits on electronic reporting, and Section 525112 is outdated as Hennepin County's 4th Judicial District no longer has county probate judges. So that's the bill. I have people here that will answer questions. However, it's my understanding that this is non-controversial, mostly technical in nature, and what's not technical is agreed to by all parties.
It would be fair to say, Representative Hillstrom, that it's there's no opposition, that there is a representative from the Supreme Court here that would give the okay for the bill?
Actually, they're the ones that brought it to me, Mr. Chair, and I have not heard from a single person that they don't like it.
Okay. Does anybody wish to have anybody come up and testify? If not, it seems like it's a non-controversial, no opposition. Anybody in opposition in the crowd?
Okay, Representative Hillstrom, I think you can just renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I renew my motion that House File 3005 be re-referred to the General Register and ask for your support.
Okay, to that motion with no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Johnson, you want to chair while I...
Representative Cornish, you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 3193 to be referred to the General Register.
So, go ahead with your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, with a short introduction, what we would be doing here is codifying a practice here that would remove the copay for mental health services, and I have somebody here to testify for me, if you would allow her.
Go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Department of Corrections, and actually, Representative Cornish said it perfectly. It codifies our current practice. It's a very simple bill. We have not been charging copayments for mental health services for as long as I can remember, and the statute was inconsistent with our practice, so we're just trying to make the statute consistent with current practice.
Thank you. And that's the bill.
Is there any questions? Representative Dean.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Cornish. This is a question that might be outside of the bill. What do we do with inmates that have chronic conditions, whether it's, you know, that they're taking medication for to treat, and they don't have the resources to actually pay the copay? I mean, are they still getting their, you know, chronic condition medication so that they're not progressing to, you know, much greater damage?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, we don't charge copayments for follow-up visits, for chronic care visits. If they're on high blood pressure medication or insulin, we don't charge copayments for that. If somebody is indigent, of course, we're not going to not provide them care just because they can't pay a copay. So they just go into debt, and if they make some money, then it falls in line. So, no, they are not at all neglected from care if they can't pay the copayment.
Mm-hmm. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for clarification, because it says at least $5 per visit. Is that then a sliding fee scale, or is it based on what? How high can it go?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, the current copay is $5. We don't want to increase it any more than what it was. Actually, the legislature increased it about 2 or 3 years ago from $3 to $5. So we're fine at $5 at this point. The offenders make about 50 cents an hour, so $5 is pretty okay.
Is there... Anyone from the public wish to testify on this bill? Representative Cornish, you wish to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to renew my motion. House File 3193 be referred to the General Register.
With that, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Same sign. The bill is moving forward.
You can go ahead and adjourn if you want.
This public safety and crime prevention is now adjourned.